Hi, and welcome to another episode of The Leadership Enigma. And I'm looking forward to this one because a picture paints a thousand words, and so does a brand. A number of clients now are talking to me about executive presence and personal branding. So this episode is titled Be a Corporate Diplomat. And I have the wonderful Alison Stewart Allen with me, who's the CEO of International Marketing Partners, author of Working with Americans, broadcaster. She's been on The Apprentice, don't you know? Speaker and non-executive director. And now she's coming to the Leadership Enigma. So join me just after this.
In a constantly changing world, today is as simple as it gets. You're listening to The Leadership Enigma, a podcast to explore, experiment, and power up your leadership to make the difference to your business, your people, and your success. Whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, or corporate executive, each week we dig deep into global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts, and disruptors. Now, here's your host, Adam Pacifico.
Alison, welcome to the Leadership Enigma. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you, Adam?
Yeah, it's good to see you. And I've been looking forward to this episode because we had a chat a couple of weeks ago and I loved the title when you first mentioned it, Be a Corporate Diplomat. So let's start there. What does that mean when we say be a corporate diplomat?
Yeah, that's such a good question. Well, if you think about a diplomat more generally, what she or he is basically doing is ensuring that they can engage a wide variety of people very effectively, that they don't mess up and put their foot in their mouth and say something that could be offensive or alienating. And at the same time, they fly the flag for their country. In the corporate sense, they do all of those things, except they fly the flag for their company.
Right.
And so they therefore need to be really aware of how what they do and say in one part of the world, how that could look in another part of the world.
And I assume there's a personal element to that as well, isn't there? A personal branding piece too.
Absolutely. You need to, ideally, you speak the language of the local place. Even if you're not fluent in the local language, you at least attempt to learn the basic thank you, please, where is, you know, the train station, some basic phrases. But yes, you do your best to assimilate. That doesn't mean you lose yourself and you become a different person and you abandon who you are. It means that you stay who you are, but you're much more skillful in building a rapport because you demonstrate that local understanding.
That nuance. Now, before we go any further forward, let's talk a little bit about you because I introduced you as the CEO of International Marketing Partners, author, broadcaster, speaker, non-executive director. And let's be fair, Alison, every time I turn on Sky News, you're on Sky News. So you're one of the most famous people I know. So how did you get to where you are now and have this passionate focus and be really a leading authority on leadership and brands and this element of being a corporate diplomat? Tell us about a little bit about the journey.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you. Well, I guess very briefly, I started in strategy consulting in LA, which is where I'm originally from.
Right.
And I've been in London for 32 years. I'm a French and German speaker.
You're a Londoner now, really, Alison. Let's be honest.
I guess so. I don't sound like one, but maybe because I've been here this long, I am one. I think you're right. Yeah, so I wanted to live in Europe again. I was raised in Munich for a few years as a kid, really wanted to come back, want to use that international experience. And really what interests me is this arbitrage of between cultures.
Right.
And that's really what I do for a living. And I'm trying to educate.
I quite like that as a sound.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. That's quintessentially English. I'm keeping that in, Alison. Quintessentially English.
Okay.
Is that a carriage clock making that noise?
It is. Yes.
I told you were London. I told you you were British. But how did you get to focus on leadership and brands? Because you are like the go-to person now on so many of the news channels. How did that happen?
Well, I guess it started oddly enough with my days at PA Consulting Group when nobody else wanted to take the media inquiries. Right. And I think I was the last resort. And I said, sure, I'll try it. And I thought, well, this is actually really good practice to try to distill technical stuff into some user-friendly terminology. And I actually really like it. And it pushes you to have to articulate complicated ideas more easily. And I guess, really, I've been doing this for such a long time that I've built up these relationships with different broadcasters and, you know, let them know the stuff I'm interested in. I put points of view out there, sometimes on social media, sometimes directly to the news producers. And occasionally they say, oh, okay, yes, come and talk to us about that.
And I have to ask, how did The Apprentice happen?
Actually, it's a very funny story, funny to me. So I was doing an interview for The One Show, and I was told that the interviewer would be along shortly. We were doing the interview at the back of my office where there's a lovely garden.
Right.
So would I hang out in my office and wait for the interviewer, and then we would do the piece. Meanwhile, the crew were setting up in the cold garden at one early morning in the winter. And this interviewer showed up, very nice man. We do the interview. He comes back in my office afterwards to get his briefcase and says, oh, I used to be in the marketing business. I had a PR agency. I sold it many years ago. Now I just do, you know, bits, lots of different bits and pieces. And I said, okay, really? Like what? At which point he gave me a funny look, like, what is she really asking me that question? Right. And he said, well, I'm on this show you might have heard of called The Apprentice. I work alongside Alan Sugar and Karen Brady in helping, you know, nurture some of these applicants. And I said, oh, right, okay. So I still didn't really know who it was. And it turns out, I'm sure your listeners are very aware of Nick Hewer. And Nick very kindly said, you know, you'd be a great panelist on our show, The Apprentice, You're Fired. Give me your business card. And the production company got in touch and said, we'd love to have you. We need more business people who are generalists and have your sort of background. So there I was. So four seasons on. Hopefully I'll be back for a fifth season later on.
When things go back to normal. Yeah, for sure. And the rest is history, I think, as they say. So let's come back to being a corporate diplomat. Why is this so important for people? I know we'll talk about the do's and don'ts, but just why is this so important for people to grasp?
Yeah, I think it's really important for people to grasp because, in fact, amplified by COVID-19 and working through screens and right. Zoom and Teams and all these virtual ways of interacting. You've got to really pay attention to what you say and how it will land. And with a variety of people from different backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the risk is unless you are paying attention to what you say and how you say it, you're going to get yourself in trouble. And there are so many examples of corporate leaders who have said things like, oh, stop moaning. Uh-huh. Which happened quite recently.
Yeah, that's not long ago. That's very recent.
Accounting firm.
Yeah.
And that leader, if that's the right word to describe him, has now exited the business. So, you know, you've got to be aware of, you know, the variety and the diversity of the people that you're leading. And I'm not suggesting you should be boring and bland and water everything down and be, you know, a wallflower, not at all. But you also need to make sure that you're not going to offend people and say things that are inappropriate. Mm. Because maybe they're appropriate in your home country, but they may not be appropriate for other people. So that's what I mean by, you know, a corporate diplomat. It's about inclusivity. It's about recognizing that diversity is inherently good and getting the best out of a diverse group by giving them messages and ideas that resonate with them.
So really, at one end of the scale, this can be career ending or can have a huge impact on an organization, perhaps even detrimental to the share price, perhaps. And you mentioned inclusivity, and a culture of inclusivity is something I'm passionate about, working with clients on that all the time. But when you said, you know, things have gone wrong, historically, there have been examples of that. You know, there's a twinkle in my eye, Alison, because I think you've got some examples to share with us, haven't you? So put me out of my waiting. What have you got for us?
Okay. Well, one product that, so I have a little cabinet in my office of a cabinet of curiosities.
Right.
And whenever I go on international business trips or even vacations, if I see something, a product, and I think, oh my God, that would never work in outside that country.
Yep.
I tend to collect it and stick it in this cabinet. And again, in a way, it's a version of corporate diplomacy. It's basically saying that if a company would ever export or sell overseas, some of the names of these products I'm about to show you,
yes,
they would get them in trouble because it would offend. So one product here is the Boudreaux's butt paste. So for those of us that have young children or have had young children, we have nappy creams with polite word names like Sudocrem.
Yes.
We don't call it Boudreaux's butt paste. Oh, and, you know,
I'd love to have been in the room when they named that, Allison.
So luckily, this product has stayed in the United States and hasn't been renamed for overseas markets, which it would need to do. You cannot call a product that in this country or most of Europe, for example. So another little example I've got is from the Body Shop, and right. I picked this up in Tokyo, and it's a facial spray called Spa Wisdom Japan Apricot and Rice Finishing Mist. And the reason that's really interesting to me is because this is a product only available in Japan.
Right.
Now, Body Shop's a global brand,
yes,
and it's demonstrating its corporate diplomacy by not trying to take its range and impose it everywhere. It's allowing local markets to do local things because that's what will resonate in those places. So this for me is a good example of corporate diplomacy.
That's the global local balance, isn't it, that always exists in so many businesses.
Absolutely. And how you get that global local balance is not straightforward and requires some dedicated time and attention from corporate leaders to recognize we cannot impose our template on the world. We've got to let some localization happen.
Right.
Definitely. So, in fact, on that theme of localization, too, Starburst, the chewy candies.
Yes.
My
children love that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, in Australia, they have another product instead, which is called Starburst Sucks. And these are lollipops. That is the Starburst candy flavors, but in a lollipop form.
Okay.
And a suck in Australia is a lollipop. So again, you can see why that product name wouldn't work in the UK.
Yeah,
or the
they're not
States.
Critiquing themselves in some way. That's just relevant to that market. Gotcha. All right.
Exactly.
I do
exactly.
love these.
Now, here's something where I think it's quite a cultural insight. So the Reese's Pieces people and Reese's Peanut Butter Cup brand have a product that's very popular in the United States called Fast Break. It's
right.
a candy bar. And why I bought this was because it gave me a lot of insight about the psyche of the Americans who are told, have a break, but you better have it fast. Whereas over here, when you have a break, have a Kit Kat.
Yes.
In other words, take your time, don't have it fast, make it last, have it slow, have it with a coffee, a cup of tea, get out of the office, slow down. Whereas in the US, it's no, don't slow down, have your break, and you better damn do it quickly because, you know, time is money sort of thing.
Yeah, that's probably consistent with quite consistent with the US employment laws, I think, Alison.
Yes.
Maybe comparable with that. So these are great examples, aren't they, of where it can go wrong through no mischief. Have they just not done their analysis? Have they not done proper investigation? Have they not really spoken to have boots on the ground? How is this happening?
Well, it's such a good question. I mean, it's happening in part because the bigger the company, the more fragmented it is.
Right.
And the less likely different business units and different geographies compare notes. So let me give you one more example.
Please.
The trainer brand, tennis shoe brand, soccer shoe brand, Umbro.
Right.
Launched a shoe model in the United States and globally all on the same day, as you do. Because that's how it works in that sector. And typically every sort of 6 to 8 weeks, a new model of shoe is launched by all the major players.
Right.
So Umbro decide they're going to launch this shoe and ship it globally all on the same day. So Umbro, a British company, has this shoe, and this model is called Zyklon B. Now, it arrives in New York City.
Yep.
To the Foot Locker stores and all of the other major sporting goods retailers and shoe retailers, and it's rejected. And the UPS and the logistics companies are told, no, we're not putting this in our store. It's got to go back. Now, for those of your listeners that are historians, they will know that Zyklon B was the name of the nerve gas during the Nazi concentration camp era that was used in the gas chambers. Now, how could a company the size of Umbro give a shoe brand, a shoe model, the name Zyklon B, when a simple Google search would have told you what this meant?
It defies belief.
It does. It does. But, you know, I'll give you another example in the shoe space.
Right.
A very famous American shoe brand called Stuart Weitzman, that's mostly a women's shoe brand, has generally fairly upmarket ranges of shoes. They're rather expensive.
Right.
But they launched 2 years ago, they launched a boot that Meghan Markle wore, and immediately there was a run on this shoe model because everyone thought, well, if Meghan Markle's wearing it, it must be trendy and cool. And the name of that shoe model, which I ended up purchasing, by the way, just to confess, is called Veruca.
Right.
And it's not spelled the way it's spelled at your local pharmacy when you buy a treatment for your verruca. It's spelled V-E-R-U-K-A. And again, you know, Stuart Weitzman serves a global market. And it must have known that it was going to supply its UK stores with a shoe called Veruca. So, you know, you do wonder sometimes about the extent of due diligence that these companies do, which affects their corporate brand, and therefore they're not seen as corporate diplomats because they make mistakes like these.
These are extraordinary examples, aren't they? And they're catastrophic. And in some ways, Alison, wouldn't we have loved to have been flies on the wall when the debate took place as to how they got to that point? And as I say, it does defy belief, doesn't it? So let's link this to leadership, shall we? Because leaders, organizations, brands, sometimes inextricably linked. What's the role of leadership in this challenge?
Yeah, well, it seems to me it's about unifying an organization. And ensuring that there is some degree of consistency around the culture, around approaches to global markets that ensure that A, risks are managed, including risks around naming your products and standing by them. But really, you're there to inspire others and to help translate a business strategy into bite-sized pieces that people can relate to at all levels of the organization and can see what that ultimate goal is and the parts that they play in delivering that, in getting to point B and the milestones along the way. And knowing that we all play an individual role, that when you aggregate it up, you get to point B. And that's the role of good leadership, is translating the big idea into ways that all of us in an organization can relate to, and to do it with energy, do it with inspiration, do it with creativity, and do it while being ourselves. And for me, that's what leadership really should look like.
And how can leaders transfer this in relation to their own personal branding as well? Because we hear the term executive presence and personal branding a lot. Can they transfer this across?
Yes, they have to transfer this across. They have to, because if they don't, then they're not being themselves. And, you know, our bullshit detectors are now finely tuned. And when someone is not being themselves, we know very instantly. So really, it's about being yourself, by getting people to point B and demonstrating you're doing that and being true to your values and declaring to people what your values are, declaring your humanity, because we follow people. We don't follow business plans, much as, you know, some would like us to believe. We don't follow milestones and KPIs. We follow people. And we're only going to follow people we can relate to, who are human, who demonstrate empathy. And so the best leaders are all those things. And the best leaders make clear what their values are and what they stand for and what they believe in. And we sign up to that when we agree to follow them, just like when we agree to follow a brand. You know, why do we go to the same supermarket every week? Is it because we're hostages to that market because there aren't others around? Or is it because we really think that they're doing a good job, so we stay loyal? So followership, you know, is very much a function of the leader creating the right conditions for us to follow.
Well, they say, don't they, that people don't normally leave bad jobs, they leave bad bosses, don't they? It's all about the people. And this really resonates, Alison, because I'm passionate about human-centered leadership. So much of my focus, the collective focus, is on human-centered leadership. You mentioned something too when we chatted a couple of weeks ago, which I thought was a lovely phrase, and I wanted you to talk a little bit more about it. You said, brands are the body language of the business. Now, that might be simple to understand. I don't know. Tell us a little bit more about that. Brands are the body language of the business. What did you mean by that?
Yeah. So in a way, a brand is the manifestation of what goes on inside the organization.
Right.
It's almost like your child. It's the gesture that is the commercial manifestation of all that magic and chemistry that goes on inside the business. And so, you know, that's often also why sometimes pretty much every company will have got this wrong. Just like we get body language wrong.
Yep.
You know, we may do the wrong thing and do the wrong gesture and, you know, give a big hug to our Japanese colleagues, which would be completely inappropriate. Right. So if we do that, you know, imagine doing that in the context of a product or a service where we launch it and it's just not quite right. It doesn't really, it's not fit for purpose, all the things that go with body language. So yes, I think it's quite important that we're paying attention to the fact that it's an expression of the company.
Yeah, I think that's a great point to make, because there's no hiding from it once it's out in the public, I assume, as well. And yeah, people have long memories, well, at times. You also said to me a couple of weeks ago that companies can't just use their global template and hope for the best. So are we back to that global local piece now about really giving the power to those who are closest to the market to make the decisions that are appropriate?
So we are, but with a caveat.
Okay.
So managing this global and local tension is something that leaders need to do at all times.
Right.
It isn't something that you do once a year and say, okay, well, here we are, budgeting season. We're looking at next year's business plan, and the regions are screaming with discontent because the product and service isn't really aligning to the local needs. So you know what? This coming business plan year, we're going to devolve power. We're going to let the regions just run away with it. Let them do local stuff. And, you know, let's see how it goes, and we'll check back in next year. That is not how to do it, because that pendulum, it takes 5 years between that devolution moment,
right,
and the pain that's felt from not managing that very well. Because if you do devolve to local places and you let local leaders in market make decisions around communication, product development, other operational aspects, there will be lots of reinvention of the wheel. On the other hand, if you totally centralize everything, then the markets there's less relevance of your value propositions to local markets. So you have to strike a balance in this dilemma, which is what it is. It's a dilemma.
Yeah.
You have to constantly manage it and assess in real time, how well is this working? Do we do the 80-20 Pareto principle where, you know, 80% is centralized and 20% is devolved? Do we do another combination? Do we hopefully look at it every few weeks, depending on your industry? So it requires active management. It isn't a annual exercise of, okay, well, this year, you know, we'll let the locals do local things. That is just really not going to pay off, and it's expensive.
And we talk about constant change, don't we? So as you say, this is something that's got to be looked at all the time, consistently, constantly. And I think what I'm hearing is what you can't afford to do is nothing.
Correct. No action is not an option, which is a very complicated phrase.
In other words, not an option.
Action is the only option.
Gotcha.
So yes, it needs active intervention from the business to decide how we're going to meet the global and the local markets at the same time. And it, you know what? It can be done without that five-year pendulum swing, which costs everybody time and money and motivation and frustration. It's just not worth it.
Now, the beauty and the frustration all wrapped up in one of the Leadership Enigma is I get to meet great people and have great conversations about subjects which we could talk about for a long time. And I know you have a cabinet of curiosities that we could delve into for many hours yet, and that would just be me being self-indulgent. But as leaders are listening to this, and it could be a young entrepreneurial leader, it could be a very experienced and seasoned leader within a FTSE and Fortune company, and this is on their mind, I'm not saying that we, or you, have all the answers right now, but how can they start? What kind of top tips might you have for them to start to appropriately think and action this subject of being a corporate diplomat?
Well, I'm afraid it's going to require some air miles. You can't easily do it through a screen, although, you know, because of COVID.
Yeah, hence the challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. The working from home, the Zoom and other platforms trying to, you know, get work done in two dimensions rather than a 3D face-to-face meeting. You've got to leave the fishbowl. And you've got to go to other fish bowls and see what they're like. I mean, there's an expression I use a lot, which is fish don't know they're in water.
Right.
Until they're taken out. And then they think, oh, no, wow, this is amazing. I can't breathe. This is air. And I don't know what to do in this context. Stick me back in my comfortable fishbowl and I'll be okay. So it's the same thing for any senior leader. They have to get out. They have to see how the rest of the world works. Because if their assumptions aren't challenged by this, then they will merrily continue as now. And you don't know what you don't know until your assumptions are challenged. And the best way to do that, especially if you're trying to scale your business internationally, is to go to these places, go to these countries that you have your sights set on, and observe, hang out at the cafe, watch what people do, you know, observe behavior, talk to lots of colleagues in those markets to understand why the template doesn't fit. And that will be a great thing for you to appreciate. And that's part of the richness of, for me, why I do the work I do, why I love the international aspect of business, because it does challenge your assumptions to say, you know, do the Europeans want a Trenta-sized coffee, which is 30 ounces, that Starbucks put on UK countertops 3-4 years ago? All it communicated was, hi, we're Starbucks. We have a 30-ounce giant big gulp coffee cup.
That's a bucket, right? Essentially, it's a bucket.
It's a bucket. It is a bucket. And it's a very big straw that comes with it, by the way.
Fire hose.
And, you know, won't this sell everywhere? Well, of course not. It didn't sell well in the UK. And if anything, it reminded people, look, this must be an American company that isn't bothering to listen to our culture, because they actually think we would want a bucket of coffee. Gotcha. So it actually reverberates and also ricochets back to the brand if you're showing that you don't really get it, you don't understand how the local place works.
You know, Alison, it just highlights to me again how important those ethnography skills are for people to truly understand their clients and their customers. I talked to Nick Jankel a couple of episodes ago about transformational leadership, and he talked about people have got to find a harmony between the inside out and the outside in. And I think there's great relevance to what you're talking about for people to, we've got to get things right internally, the process and the procedure and the infrastructure and the people, but we can't ignore the outside world and make sense of it and really understand who we're trying to sell to. Is that a fair comment?
I think it's a very fair comment. I like, I use an analogy from biology,
right,
about the permeable membrane. So the organization is a loose, permeable membrane, and it interacts with the environments around it. And if it doesn't, and it decides that it's going to build, a secure fortification,
yep,
around the organization to protect itself, that is the moment you know that that business is not listening. And the best organizations are open. They are good listeners. They invite dissent. They are not defensive. And they want the other perspective. They want to see the full spectrum of options, not just tell me what, you know, the echo chamber. Tell me what I already know and believe in, because that'll make me feel better.
Yeah.
And we know, I'm sorry to say, that there are many leaders that aren't too happy in environments that challenge their beliefs.
And they'll be the ones that find that they fall foul of some of these things. Now, this is great advice, Alison. So my question to you is, in this short episode, we've touched upon, I think, some critical themes for people to think about. How can people get hold of you, get in touch with you and join the debate, find out more, or get you to help them? I know you help thousands of individuals. How can they get hold of you?
So a couple of key ways.
Okay.
One is visiting our website, www.intermarketingonline.com.
Okay.
I can be reached on email, which is Alison@intermarketingonline.com. Or they can visit workingwithamericans.com, our book about the U.S. business culture. There's a couple of free chapters that you can steal and circulate. We'd be delighted if you
wanted to. It's called Borrow with Pride, Alison. They're going to borrow it with pride.
Absolutely.
There's the lawyer in me. Did you see that?
So there's a few key ways, and I'd love to hear from people on these topics.
That's brilliant. I've got one last question to finish off this wonderful episode. And here it is. What would be your best advice to a 21-year-old Alison?
Good question. My advice, well, there's two pieces.
That's okay.
One is persistence pays off, because in my case it has. So I would tell the younger Alison to stick with things and see them through and not give up in the face of what might feel like eternal rejection.
Right.
And I think the other thing is, the world is your oyster. So, you know, look around at all of the diverse points of view, the different ways we do things, the different ways we use diaper cream, nappy cream, even the words we have for these things, and appreciate that these differences are inherently interesting because they're different, not because they're wrong or not because they're right. They're just differences. And I think those are the top top tips I would give my younger self.
And Alison, I love that. And you had no notice of that question whatsoever. But maybe if you've listened to some of the episodes right till the end, I have asked a few people that question. So that's absolutely great. Listen, thank you so much for being a superstar. I know you've had a busy day. Thank you for joining the Leadership Enigma. And I hope you'll consider doing it again. I know I'm going to have to compete with Sky News or NBC and The Apprentice, but save a little place for the Leadership Enigma as well, if you can.
I would love to, Adam. Thank you so much for inviting me to join you today.
It's great stuff.
Join us again next week for more essential insights on the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show, as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with your host on LinkedIn or via our website, www.pca-global.com. Please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes. Thanks for listening.